Everyone, how you doing? Yes, all right. Just so you know, just to set the record straight, I'm one of these presenters that needs lots of feedback, so you know, feel free to frown or smile or nod your head or something, because it helps me out, right? So, or you can just make jokes, it's fine. I'm easy either way. Hi, welcome to the DAC Effects session. For those of you, if you genuinely don't know what DACFX is, and so you came along to be told, and you're not a fan of databases, and you don't like automating stuff, I'm not going to be offended if you decide to go find another session. That's okay. It's one of these acronyms that's not very clear about what it is. My name is Hannah Gray. I am the technical group lead, which is a really fancy way of saying I'm now an ex-developer who manages other developers. And that should almost be my title. And I work at Xero. Where we use this technology. So my background is in being a back-end developer, and I have a bit of a love affair with SQL Server. So as a result, although I'm a .NET developer, I spend a lot of time mucking around with databases, hence things like SSDT and DACFX. So precautions. This is a 400-level session. I am assuming you're reasonably okay with the following. If you're not, if you're like a DBA or a SQL developer and you're thinking, ooh, object-oriented programming, go find a developer and just hug onto their arm for the rest of the session and they can walk you through it. And vice versa, if you're a developer who isn't really that comfortable with databases, right? Just find a DBA to pair up with. I say object-oriented programming, PowerShell, you'll probably be fine. You can read the code, it's all good. But this is coding intensive and I'm assuming that you are comfortable with all the rest. Right, so. On to the point, hopefully you turned up because you did actually want to know the answer to this question. What exactly is DACFX, other than a really cool acronym that everybody gets the capitalization wrong with the F and the X all the time? And the answer is a data tier application framework. So obvious, right? Totally know what that does. Yep, absolutely. What it actually is, this is the definition from Microsoft, it's the core technology SQL Server Data Tools leverages for incremental database deployments, modeling, and validation of database schemas and other key functionality. Hands up, anybody who's used SSDT or SQL Server Data Tools. Right, that might sound a lot like pretty much what SQL Server Data Tools does, so you might be wondering, well, what's the difference? And basically, it's this. SQL Server Data Tools this is the heart of SQL Server Data Tools. If you've used the Visual Studio GUI to work with SQL Server Data Tools and database projects, that is literally the GUI over the top of the data application tier framework. So everything that we tend to think of as SSDT is actually DACFX behind the scene. It is the engine behind SSDT. So all of those cool things, and that includes SQL package.exe, it's actually part of DACFX. Okay, great. You all know what DACFX is now. Congratulations, you can go to another session. Why should we care? There's an API. As a developer, there's words to my beating heart. How lovely. An API that I can program against and write code. That's fantastic. So the API, funnily enough, you've got your Visual Studio, which is kind of your GUI version, and you've got a .NET API that allows you to interact with a data tier application component, and when you do that, it spits out what we all know as a DAC pack, which is the unit of deployment or the build output, as it were. So this is cool. This means we can start modifying and playing with DAC packs programmatically. Sorry, I'm a developer. I like breaking things, right? So what exactly can you use it for, other than making DBAs' lives terrible, even more terrible than developers already do? This is pretty much it. Breaks down into four types of things that you can do with the DACFX API. So you can use the API to do exactly the same things you can with SQL package.exe, but in a programmatic way. So that might be useful if you've got some variables that are programmatic or you want to conditionally pass and set a command var, something like that. But same. In fact, it's word for word almost identical. You can do code analysis. I'm not going to go into code analysis too much today. There's actually plenty on code analysis. As a small plug, if you do want to know about code analysis, see my previous sessions at Ignites, where I've gone over and how to use them for unit testing and continuous integration. But the really cool stuff is you can customize your deployment. So you can have full control over your deployment, and you can also, this is the key, this is the kicker, because it enables all of the rest, you can interrogate and alter your database model. So you can take the model that's been declared in Visual Studio and that your developers have done, and they're like, hey, I know exactly what I'm doing. And you go, yeah, I'm just gonna fix all that stuff. And none of you will know about it. And you can actually alter it. So not just inspect it, but alter it. Very conveniently, these map directly to the namespaces of the API. So nobody's going to get confused. Nice and easy. It's all good. If you want, there's a cheat sheet. But it's pretty obvious what does what. You know, if you're in the deployment namespace, it's the stuff to do with modifying the deployment, and so on and so forth. So what do you need to get started? Well, you've got one of two things. If you have been using SSDT before, you're probably already familiar with the DAC framework, MSI, which is the redistributable version of all the libraries and things needed to do all the magic. But there's also a NuGet package which has just this part that we're talking about. So it's a subset of the DAC framework. And so it's just the API, public model API. And it comes in two bits depending on what it is you care about. Like normal SSDT, it supports all the things as long as you're not on 2005 or earlier. So all the things asterisks and Azure. So no surprises there if you've been playing around with it. So let's actually crack into some code because that's way more interesting than listening to me talk. So I am gonna have a lot of pre-cribbed code for you, and I hope that's okay, so bear with me. So the first thing I'm gonna do is we're just gonna compare, hopefully all of you can recognize a SQL package.exe command, yeah? Seeing a few nods, yes. Some blank stares as well, that's good, yep. Okay, SQL package.exe. So this is just a stock standard publish. I've got a DAC pack. I'll show you that project in a minute. It's just a normal database, nothing particularly fancy about it. I'm deploying it to my local server. I'm calling the database something unique because I want to prove that it works by itself. I've got some SQL command var that actually does nothing, but hey, I set it anyway. And some options that I want to set, some deployment options. All good, right? Okay, so just to, you know, prove that this thing works. While that's chugging away in the background, I'll just flick over here. So I've got a, oh man, it's so quick, I can't even do that. It's already finished. Okay, so we've published a database. So this is my local SQL server, and we can see I've got a deploy via SQL package database with my tables and stuff in it, right? Easy, good, wonderful. Why would you want to do anything differently? Well, because you can. So, I will be using C# for my demos. Obviously, this is a .NET API, so any .NET languages. And of course, that also means PowerShell for all of you PowerShell fans. So here I just have a very simple console app. At the moment, very empty, which is a problem. And I'm just gonna do exactly the same thing that SQL package.exe did. Line for line, exactly the same. So you can kind of see how the API works. So first things first, we definitely need that NuGet package. So install package. Once somebody remembers how to type correctly, that would really help. Microsoft SQL Server. You get really quick at typing this out, by the way, after a while. I'm only going to do that once. Oh, that's awkward. Oh, yeah, network cable. That would help, wouldn't it? Hilarious. I didn't think to ask for that. Excuse me for one moment. So the DACFX package. Just as a word of warning for those in the know, if you go onto NuGet and you search for the DACFX package, there's lots of other ones. So there's the Microsoft ones, and then they're like the least downloaded ones at the moment. So you can help them get further up in the rankings by going and downloading it. So don't be fooled. There are many imitators, but none of them are like the others. All right, try that again. Cross fingers. Anybody got like good jingles they sing to themselves while they're waiting for progress bars? I have a bad habit of humming. It really annoys everybody around me, yeah. Okay, so NuGet package installed, done. Check that one off the list. So first things first, we need to know where it is we're actually gonna deploy to. So I'm gonna create a SQL connection. So again, if you haven't done it in .NET, don't freak out, it's okay, it's all good. This is a SQL connection string builder. Hopefully you can figure out what it does from its name. And we're just saying the data source, which is a server, goes to local. I'm gonna give it a different database name to prove that this works. Deploy via DACFX API. Correct my usings. Cool, easy. So that's setting up where we're gonna deploy to. The next thing is deploy options. So this is where we start getting into the actual API of DACFX. So a deploy options object looks like this. And funnily enough, as per discussions, it lives in the DAC namespace. And the deploy options is actually really straightforward. So if we go back to our PowerShell, the three things that I'd set were ignore whitespace, include transactional scripts, and ignore semicolon between statements, right? Okay, so let's just do exactly the same thing. So ignore white space equals true. Include transactional scripts equals true. And ignore semicolon. This is the stuff dreams are made of. All right, easy. Flip back over. The other thing that was in here was a SQL command variable being set. So how do you do that, Hannah? Well, I'm so glad you asked. You didn't, I know. Okay, so deploy options again, and funnily enough, there's the SQL command variable values property, and we can add something, and we say it's called environment, and we say that the value of it is test. Boom. Easy. And very last but not least, you're thinking, great, I've set all the options, I'm not actually doing anything with it. So the last thing we need is a DAC service. So this is the thing that does the actual deploying. It needs a connection string, funnily enough, to know where it's deploying to, which I happen to have handy from my connection string builder earlier on. And then we can just say service.deploy. And it takes four parameters. First of all, it needs to know the DAC pack that it is pulling out. Anybody notice a problem with that? No DAC pack. So let's fix that. So here is just putting it in a using statement to be nice. So I'm loading up my DAC pack. I am using a direct reference. I figure you'll forgive me because it's a demo, but obviously you could pass this in as an argument or whatever it is you need to do in terms of your automation, right? So pointing to the exact same DAC pack. And we go deploy. So we're going to pass on the DAC pack that needs deploying. Target database name. Anybody know where I can get that from? Initial catalog. Really, really obvious, that one. And then the next parameter is basically saying, will you allow me to upgrade database or will you only let me deploy fresh? Now, I'm a big fan of letting SSTT do what it's really good at, which is upgrade as well as do fresh deploys. So I'm saying true, and then it's saying, do you have any deploy options? Which, of course, I do, because I really want that SQL command var to be set correctly. That's it. So hopefully you could follow that along compared to the SQL package call. Oh, so you probably want to see that work, don't you? Fine, if I have to. So I gave it a different database name, so hopefully, if this doesn't error out, we'll see another database appear. But very syntactically the same as, or similar to SQL packages, is the SQL package.exe. So that's actually reasonably straightforward, and in PowerShell it's even more similar to what you'd be used to. So if we go back up here and I do a refresh, oh yay, look, another database. Ooh ah, cool. All right, let's get on to some more fun stuff. Okay, so I managed to prove that there's an API. That's always a good start to any demo. But here's where it starts getting really interesting and complicated all at once. The T-SQL model. Anybody played with the T-SQL model? One, two. Oh, excellent. You're in for the ride of your lives. This is going to be fun, ladies and gentlemen. It's going to be great. Okay, so this is what really drives all of the DACFX stuff. The stuff that I've showed you before is kind of like, you know, the easy OSI stuff at the top, easy access. This is the way that DACFX works. Oh, sorry, DACFX API works. Your DAC pack is represented by a T-SQL model that is the object that will hold the model of your database. Everything in that database is an instance of a T-SQL object. Now you might think, why is she emphasizing that? I don't understand the significance. Don't worry, we'll get there in a bit. There are also, a T-SQL object can have properties and it can also have metadata. Let me actually put that in an example to make it way clearer. So in a given database, the T-SQL model will represent the entire database, the entire schema. And the user table will be an object of type T-SQL object. It will have some properties. Those properties might look really familiar to you. They're the same properties that you'd see in SQL Server Management Studio. But here's the really interesting thing. Everything that we would consider descendants of that is also a T-SQL object. So here's the first lesson. In the DACFX API, it's very much like dealing with reflection, if anybody's ever done that. Nothing is strongly typed, okay? It does tend to scare you just a titch at the beginning, but it's okay, it's fine. Power through it. They all have properties, but you'll notice that the properties are different with each type. So whatever that that T-SQL object is representing, the collection of properties will change. Makes sense, right? Then we throw in metadata. Metadata may or may not exist. Columns have metadata, which is the type of column. It's a thing identifying that it's an of type column. Seriously, that's a thing. So in short, everything is a T-SQL object. Permission, foreign key, index, table, view, you name it. Extended properties. They're all T-SQL objects. They have properties, the same thing as if you went right-click properties in SQL Server Management Studio, and it may or may not have metadata, depending what it is. Next concept, references. This is critical to being able to figure out your way around the database. So if you've got all these T-SQL objects and you have no idea what's what, how on earth do you say get a table and then find its children columns, right? Which is kind of what you're gonna want to do for automation. So there are four things you need to know. Get children, get parent, hopefully those two are fairly obvious, and get referenced and referencing. Again, diagram, because diagrams make things much easier to understand. This is a very small version of the models within a database. What you're seeing is the type of relationship. So DACFX represents it in three ways: peer, composing, or hierarchical. And you'll see the bits in italic is the type of relationship, and that's actually what you'd use in your code. So if you wanted to get the columns in a view, you would say, I want to get things that match this relationship of type view.columns. That's actually how you use it in the language, and again, we'll see an example of that. So you never go around using relationships, and you need to know the type of relationship that you're trying to interrogate in order to get there. How are the DBAs and SQL developers in the audience doing so far? I lost you? Oh, nice. Got some thumbs up and good. Yeah, cool. Rock on. Okay, third concept that is important is query scopes. And so, again, when you're executing essentially a query against the model, you're going to need to know what scope you're interested in. If you've been working around databases, these are pretty self-explanatory. Built-in objects, user-defined objects, system objects. Okay, they're kind of what they say on the box. Ooh, I think that was exactly what I was warned would happen if I did that. Oh yeah, that's awkward. So, once Hannah stops talking and figures out how to use technology, because apparently that's what a technical group lead does. Somebody should remove the word technical from my title. Cool, so you've got the three concepts, right? Everything is a T-SQL object. You must know relationships, and you need to know your DEC query scope that you are interested in. So, very quick demo showing how this all hangs together and that I'm not actually making this stuff up, which would be fun, to be fair. So here I have, again, this is just a little console app. I'm not going to write very much code. I'm just going to show you what comes out as we're interrogating the model of a DAC pack. So same DAC pack being loaded in. And you can see here we're loading from DAC pack. Pretty straightforward. And we give it a DAC pack. There's some certain options. Loading it as a script back model means do you want to be able to interrogate the actual, like, create script behind the objects? Or do you just need the definition of the objects themselves? One will take up more memory and be slower. If you load it as script backed, and whether you're storing it in memory or not. And then this is the most handy place to start. We want to get an object. This is the closest thing you're going to get to being able to get one specific object out of your model. So in this case, I'm saying I want to get an object of type table. Okay. And the way that it represents names, you can't just pass in a string. You need to say, and it has an object identifier that matches this object identifier, which in this case is dbo.user. So I want to get out my user table. That's what I'm querying for. And I have defined the scope of my search to user-defined objects. Hopefully, pretty straightforward. Okay, just going to run this. And what we're going to do is show you what happens as we go. Right. So, you'll notice that it started spitting out a bunch of stuff. Let's have a look at what that code's actually doing. So, under properties, I'm saying for this table of type, sorry, for this object of type table, because everything here is very loosely typed, it's all T-SQL objects, remember, give me the properties that a table is allowed to have. and then go back to my object and get that property. Anybody's mind going poof right about now? No? Good. Ah, I need to try harder. Okay, so we've iterated over all that we've said. Give us all the properties for a table. List them all out. If we move on to the next one, you'll notice there's no metadata. Remember in the slide that I said before, the tables don't have any metadata. The first thing that did was a column. So there's no metadata coming out. Again, similar sort of way of interrogating it. For this type of object, which in this case is a table, what are the metadata things I have? In this case, none. And then loop through and say, given my object, get that metadata property. Same, same. Children, now we start getting into the fun stuff. So first you can see a relationship, get children. Now you might think that that's going to be really obvious as to what it returns. This is the first child, which is a column, the ID column in the user table. And it's again, it's iterating out all the properties for that child. You'll notice we've also got some metadata spitting out this time because columns, objects of type column have metadata. If I just quickly keep going through, this is going through all of the children and listing out their properties. You'll notice eventually I get to another child of type default constraint. So again, think about your relationships. They're not always what you and I might think, well, certainly what I think of them. You know, children, I think of columns. I don't necessarily think of all the other things that are related as well. So we have default constraints, we have primary keys, we have the permissions on the table. They're also considered children. Done, okay? So that's T-SQL model. So it is a bit verbose, and you do kind of need to know what it is you're after, which is interesting. One of the things I will say is that the MSDN documentation, although very thorough in describing all the constructors and the properties and methods, it doesn't really tell you how this whole thing hooks together. So one of the best things you can possibly do if you're interested in this is just start immediately looking at other code samples, because there's very little examples online about how it all comes together. This is largely done by trial and error, these sorts of demos. So let's look at the interesting stuff. How does this come into CI and CD and doing cool stuff? So DECFX API provides three ways you can hook into the deployment pipeline. Yes. So you can either be a build contributor, which means you run during the build. You have no effect over the deploy, because it's just during the build, right? Hopefully we're all okay about the difference between build and deploy. And you might mean that you can do something sort of read-only-ish during the build. So it might be statistics or auditing or, you know, various things. I don't know what might be of interest to you to do as an additional step during the build. You can also fail the build as well, so that might also be something of interest to you. And then there's deployment plan modifiers and executors. And modifiers do exactly what they sound like. You can basically interfere with a deployment plan that's been generated by SSDT. And hopefully I've got a good one for all the DBAs in the audience who are frustrated by one of SSDT's interesting quirks. And executor is something, it's essentially a post-deploy. It's kind of at the end. So again, might be good for notifications or auditing, things like that. Right. And code analysis, again, so you can write, code analysis is normally a tool used for .NET languages. In Visual Studio, you write a rule, you enforce that your code adheres to that rule, and you get to smack developers on the wrist who write some code that doesn't adhere to that rule. It's never really gone anywhere near SQL until DECFX came out. And now you can write code analysis rules that are run by the code analysis engine, and you can put it into your build pipeline. Things like please stop using date time and use date time 2 instead. Or would you please stop using invarchar max before I have to come and hit you? Insert other SQL DBA jokes. Okay, so there's plenty of things around code analysis that are really, really cool that you can prevent at build time. So that's really useful for the continuous integration side of things. Right, less talking, more working. So let's look at these build contributors first and foremost. So for me, it's documentation. I don't know about you, but I love being able to have something that allows me to pull out the MS description field. Anybody here use the MS description field to document their database? No? Oh, wow, okay. Awkward silence. Okay, well, pretend you do for all of a few minutes. So if you do use the MS description field, one of the downsides is actually being able to pull it out in something readable and useful. There is some software out to do it, but, you know, I decided to be difficult. So what we're going to do is we're going to build a build contributor that hooks into the build, and all it does is generate documentation off, so you can see exactly what your schema looks like and what the definition of the columns are and stuff like that. Cool. All right, so first things first. I'm not going to bother keep doing NuGet package installs, so don't worry, you don't have to sit through that pain again. So first things first, this is what a build contributor looks like. It has to inherit from the build contributor class, and it has to implement the onExecute method. So if we have all the namespaces, we've got DAC deployment and DAC extensibility. That's it. That's all you have to do. You now got a build contributor. You do, however, have to tell Visual Studio, or more specifically MS Build, that this is something that can be hooked into the build pipeline. And the way that you do that is by essentially exporting it. So this is an attribute that you stick on the top, and this immediately tells Visual Studio that it can be picked up. So we're just going to call this one Stack Overflow. Documentation, I know, it's so unique a name. Did I spell overflow wrong? I did spell overflow, thank you very much. Ah, love it. Somebody's awake, yes. That's a win in my book. Okay, so the first thing is you do get in, the context that you get in has the model that we've been talking about, this whole T-SQL model thing that you can interrogate and do stuff with. So that's kind of important to use. So in this case, what I'm going to do is I'm going to pull out all of the tables. So you've kind of seen this before. So we're going to go get, in this case, get objects instead of object. And I'm going to say that I want my query scope to be default. as you can see here, default is both built-in and user-defined wrapped into one. So it's a pretty safe bet. And I want to get all the objects of type table. Dot type class. So this is me saying I want all the tables out. Cool, easy, list of tables out. Okay. Start holding onto your hats. Oh my gosh, really? Thank you. This is why I hate pair programming. Like it really is. Pair programming is just so high pressure, right? This is why they pay me not to code anymore, right? Okay, so what we're doing, we're looping through all of these tables. So this is just some skeleton code. I'm using a third-party library to write my documentation. Don't worry about that too much, doesn't really matter. But for each of the table in my list of table objects that I found, I'm going to do something. So first of all, let's write a heading. I want to have the table name right up the top. So it's going to be table.name. The names are not strings, they come in parts. So there's all the three or four part names are each in different parts in the name of the objects. So if you want to get it out, you either have to go to string or get the third part or whatever part you're interested in the name. Trick for young players. Okay, so the next thing is I want to get all the columns within the table because it's actually the column definition that usually matters the most in terms of documentation. Well, for me, at least, that's what I find. So again, we're going to declare a var columns table, and we're going get reference. Now, you might wonder why I'm going get reference instead of get children like last time. So you'll remember that get children last time returned a whole bunch of other things that I don't actually care about. I just want the columns. So in this case, I need to be very explicit about the relationship that I'm interested in interrogating, hence using get referenced. So I'm saying get referenced, and again, I'm going to say I'm going to say it's table.columns. That is the type of relationship that I am trying to query. We all still good? Yes, excellent. Okay, so here's where it starts getting interesting. Those of you who've ever used MS Description, it's an extended property, not to be confused with the properties we talked about before. So it's an extended property, which means it's a T-SQL object hidden somewhere in a relationship to do with this column. So now I have to find it. So the description property, I'm going to say column, get referencing. So we're going the other way. I want to find the thing that references this column rather than the other way around. Okay. And the relationship here, because this is particularly, like, where did this come from, is extended property to host. So from the extended property to the host that it's on, that's the relationship that I'm trying to interrogate. You know all this stuff. You can totally work this out. It's all good, yeah. Bit of link in here just to throw anybody off. Apologies if it does. It's not intended. Missing a few references. Come on. Oh, yeah. See? Ah, that's because I don't have it in my for statement. Yeah. So I told you, pair programming, right? Who here enjoys pair programming? Oh, nobody. Oh, one person raised their hand. Okay. It was saved. It was saved. Nice job. Okay. So I'm going to, based on the extended property.host relationship, I'm going to get back all the objects that are of that type of relationship with the object that I've got, which in this case is a column of the table that I'm interested in. And then I'm going to get the first one back, because if there are multiple MS descriptions, I actually don't care at this point. I just want the one extended property. That'll do me just fine. So I'm going to get the first one back. And you can have multiple extended properties, right? So how do I know it's MS description as opposed to some other extended property that my DBA has added to track I don't know what? So, of course, we're going to have to get a little bit dirty and say, well, actually, I need you to check that the last part of the name, so the very last part, is equal to MS description. And this is a pretty, you'll see this in a lot of code examples as to, in terms of how to get out the exact object that you're after when you're traversing down relationships. Okay, so now that we've hopefully got a property, if there is a extended property of MS description on that column, we need to actually pull out what the value of it is. Almost there. So if the description property is not equal to null, we're going to pull out the value. And again, this isn't going to be quite as straightforward as you might think. So a description is going to be cast to a string of a description property, get property, extended property, dot value. Ooh. Go with the documentation. Okay. Are you generally following along what's going on, though? Yeah? Okay, got a lot of nods. Good. That's all I can ask for at this point. That's good. That's good. Okay, so get my documentation working out right. So I want a header with my name and my column, and then I want a little table that lists all of the columns in the other table in there. Okay, so last but not least, we're going to add that to my documentation. So I'm going to add a row, and it's going to be the column.name, and I'm going to pick the last part because I don't want to have the whole fully qualified name, because that's stupid. I already know what table I'm in. And I'm going to add the description, if it exists, from the MS description. And just to finish that off, I'm then also going to add a note. Because I don't know about you, but I find that after I've written code, I can't remember where it starts spitting things out. Where did that thing write to again? I don't remember. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to add into the errors. So you might recall right up at the beginning, one of the other things that was passed in other than context, which held the model, was this list of extensibility errors. Don't ask me why it's called errors. You can actually print warnings or messages or any of the other sorts of things that you would normally see in an SSDT deploy or build. So very useful if you want to spit out some sort of status or abort or any of those sorts of things. And of course, cross fingers. Of course I was going to miss something. Okay, so we've now got a build contributor that apparently looks at all of the tables, then looks at all the columns for the tables, finds the MS description property, pulls that out, and then shoves it in what is hopefully something that's writing a document in the background, so that my developers can always adhere to using the columns in the right way that they are intended, right? Yeah? Okay. So how do you get this? I mentioned before that you had to export it. How do we get this into the build pipeline? Well, there's two things. One, the build pipeline looks in a specific place for these extensions. So you need to copy your DLL. So if you had a build server or anything like that, obviously you'd be copying that into that build server in this particular location. So in my case, I'm going to cheat, and I'm going to copy it into mine. Now, unfortunately, Visual Studio does use that folder, so you have to close Visual Studio to load up the extensions, of course, naturally. But now that it's been copied over, you'll see here I'm just running an MS build. If you haven't run that before, that's just the command line version of doing a build in Visual Studio. I'm building my SQL project, which has my database for my DAC pack, and I'm just passing in this extra parameter, build contributors equals, and the name that I had up the top in that export statement, right? Oh, yes. If we scroll up, we should see document available at. Yeah. Nice. And if I have a look at that location, documentation.docx. Oh, yeah. On the fly documentation for every build. Thank you very much. I'll be here all day. Oh, come on. That's a big deal. I think that's a big deal anyway. But oh, thank you. Thank you. Not that that was forced clapping, but thank you. So this is the example of what you can do with a build contributor, really powerful stuff that you can hook into every build. And obviously, because it's got this parameter on the end, you don't always have to have it in every build on every developer's workstation. It could just be added on your CI server or your deployment servers or anything like that. So really powerful in terms of when you can flick it on and off. And of course, you can have multiple build contributors. You can keep chaining them as many as you like. So that's your build contributor. Right, on to the next one, which is even more fun, which is interfering with the deployment plan. Oh, okay, so the question was, I said that you could have multiple build contributors, and I think the question is, like, what order do they execute in? Is that what you're asking? Right. You know what? I actually have no idea. I think it's the way order in which they're declared and loaded from the extensions folder, but I actually have never tested that, so that's a really good question. I might have to have a go, have a play. Yeah, sorry. I've definitely seen examples with multiple, but I've never checked the order in which they load. Yeah. Good point. Look, it could simply be the order in which it loads it from the extension folder, which could be alphabetical for you know. So, sorry, not much use to on that one. Right, so deployment plan modifier. Okay, so let's move on to a deployment plan modifier. So, let me see if any of you recognize this scenario. I have this DAC pack, and I'm a lovely developer with the best of intentions, and I come along and I go, oh, I'm going to help the DBA out. I'm just going to like add this column in. And they said I needed to add a new column in, and like I think it should be after the tag name column. So I'm going to call it my column. Anybody starting to groan at this point? Yeah, okay. Yeah, I like that order of columns, right? Because that doesn't matter in the slightest. And right about now, SSDT then starts trying to do, well, hopefully most of you know what it's going to do. Just prove it. I'll try and publish this. If I generate the script, we should see a rather spectacular table rebuild that it tries to do in order to drop the table, completely rebuild it with the columns in the right order, and shovel the data across. And if you're anything like me, that's not actually what you want to happen in that scenario. And the last thing that you really need to do, yeah, here we go, dropping all the foreign keys, creating a temporary table, moving the data across, doing an SPRM. No. So it would be much better if you could actually abort that to begin with, right, as part of the deployment. Now, you can't do it at build time because you don't know that it's going to happen because it depends very much on the target you're deploying it to. So you only know at deployment time that it's actually going to be a problem. And to be honest, the last thing that DBAs need to be doing is generating a script and sitting there going control F to see if they can see alter table anywhere in the script. It's a complete waste of your time, right? So, and you can sit there and try and beat the developers over the head as much as you like, but let's just face it, you know, automation is going to win all the time. So, don't worry, I insult both disciplines equally, so it's all equal opportunity here. So we're going to do, it's very same to what we did before with the build contributor. Going to add a class. And funnily enough, it's going to have to inherit from a deployment plan modifier. And it's going to have to implement on execute. And it's going to have an export statement up the top that says what it is. So by now, this is looking pretty familiar, hopefully. Now, this one's a bit of a doozy. Okay. So here's what we're going to do. I want to detect if somebody has inadvertently caused what SST2 referred to as a data motion. In other words, what we would call a table rebuild, or that particular scenario we're seeing of it dropping everything and trying to recreate the table. So it's actually, SSTT can actually recognize that. It doesn't think it's an alter table. It actually thinks it's something called a SQL data motion. So I want to look for it in the deployment plan, and I just want to like bail out as quickly as possible. That's it. So one of the things you get with the, in the same way we had the context last time, that gave us the model. In this case, we don't get a model, we get the deployment plan itself. That's the context we get. So, and the unit, the sort of type of object that you're dealing with, the deployment steps. So in this case, we're gonna start off with the very first step. So the context that gets passed in has a plan handle, and it has a head and a tail, the very first and last step that are gonna be executed. Unfortunately, at the moment, the only way you can find the step that you were interested in or see if there's any steps there that match your criteria is to iterate through them from top to bottom. So there's nothing particularly elegant about this one. So, break out your while loops. So what we're doing here is we are going through the steps, but really we're looking for a set of conditions. First of all, we know we don't want the pre-deployment script, so we can ignore everything that's before that. Once we hit the end of the pre-deployment script, we know we're starting to get into the meaty bit that we actually care about. We also know that once we get to the beginning of the post-deployment script, we've gone too far, so we can bail out at that point. And everything in between, we actually care about and look at. So that's all this is doing. It's looping through until it finds that. So by the time it gets down here, we know it's after the end of the pre-deployment and before the beginning of the post-deployment. We're somewhere in the middle. Sweet spot. Okay. So that step we now know is a script step because we know we're in that part of the scripting process. And the if statement is very simple. If step is a SQL table migration step. That's it. That's all I need to know. If it's of that type of step, and I can look at more properties, I can look at the tables involved, I can look at all sorts of other things underneath that step, there are all sorts of properties there, but that's really kind of it. So I can throw, very similar, in this case you use publish message to push out an extensibility error. I'm gonna say, get me out of here, Jim, because somebody made a bit of a mistake. And I don't want to do a table rebuild on my production database while there are a couple million users on it, because that would be kind of bad. Right, so similar thing again. In this case, a deployment extension is used by SQL package, not MS build. SQL package has its extensions in a slightly different location, but the same principle applies. There's an extensions location, you need to copy that DLL to that location for it to be loaded up, right? So that's what I'm just doing here as my cheat. And very last but not least, we come all the way back to SQL package.exe. This is the same as before, except with two slight differences. One, I'm scripting it, just because I want to show you what's going to happen without actually deploying it yet. And you'll notice that again, there's an additional argument, in this case, additional deployment contributors, specifying what contributor I want to run. And again, you can chain these. You can also pass in parameters as well. So if we run this, I did build, excellent. Building is good. Could not generate deployment script. Get me out of here, Jim. So that script has been aborted, and just to prove it's not actually unique to scripting, if I actually try and update, so publish to that database, it will fail as well. But it won't fail if I were to publish to a completely new database. Why? Because there is no data motion going on there. It is a completely clean deploy. Did I actually hit F8? Probably not. Oh, no, I did. So, same thing. So, we've now managed to introduce some automation that would mean that, you know, even if somebody was having a bad day and that overslept and that production release still has to go out, it prevents something as catastrophic as potentially finding out you're doing a table rebuild in the middle of doing a table rebuild, which is not really pleasant for anyone. So what? What's the big deal? Really, you know, it's the limit of your imagination in terms of what you can do with this. Some of the things that I've been dreaming up are around dealing with cross-environment schema objects, so logins that only exist in pre-production, for example. We have automated test logins that only exist there, but I prefer them to be in source control and under SSDT rather than in a script somewhere. So they're strongly typed in source control, but then we can strip them out when we deploy to production. That would be kind of nice. The other one is edition-dependent features. Anybody here have Enterprise SQL Server? Yeah, a couple of you. Online index rebuilds, biggest time saver ever, right? And effort saver. SSDT out of the box doesn't support them. The script that it generates doesn't have online. There is a modifier, it's actually available online, that you can use that will find out what version you're deploying to, and if so, it'll put online rebuilds on when it detects that an index needs to be rebuilt. So those sorts of things are quite good. Auditing or notifications. One example that I've come up with is CDC. If you've got any databases that have CDC on them, you're doing deploys to them, you want the deploy to go ahead, but you need to make sure that, say, that other party restarts their CDC process so that the data is recopied across. That can be missed. It's a very manual thing at the moment to notify somebody if you've made a schema change to a table that's under CDC. And the availability groups, that's the other one. So if you deploy to the primary and everything else apart from server objects like logins get replicated across. So you could easily create something that plugged into it, detected that you were part of an AG group, and generate the script for the logins to make sure that you get logins with the exact same SID on the secondaries. It's currently something that I know DBAs usually manually have to do after doing the automatic deployment to the primary. So those are the sorts of things. There's plenty of others that I'm sure you can think of. Hopefully some of you have come up with some ideas. If you are looking for resources, the best ones that I can recommend are these. The SQL Server Data Tools team has an excellent blog post just explaining the model, this theory behind everything being loosely typed and all the rest of it. So it's a good starting point. MSDN do have three walkthroughs on how to build each of the three types of contributors that I've gone through. I've gone through two of them, but the other, last one was the one at the end, which is like a read-only one. They have an example. They are pretty in-depth in terms of walkthroughs. They're not exactly the simplest implementation of them, but again, good place to start. Actually, number three is really, I can't recommend more. It's published by Microsoft. It's a GitHub project called DAC Extensions, and it's full of sample projects, sample contributors, sample code analysis rules, all those sorts of things. So if you're looking for, I have no idea how this is supposed to work, go in there and have a look. You'll find an example of what it is you want to do. And I personally would recommend the bottom one. If you're generally interested in sort of SSDT and automation, DACFX in general, being used in a CI and CD environment, SQL Concepts, Kent Chenery, is right up there in New Zealand in terms of leading the way in automation and figuring out how we can do things. So that's me. Please fill in your evaluations so you can say how terrible my jokes were, because I love hearing that sort of feedback. I hope that you took away something of interest today and that you have a very good afternoon.